Thanks for tuning in to Coastal Conversations here on WERU. We explore issues facing Maine's coastal communities through dialogue with people who live, work, and play on our coast. Coastal Conversations is supported by Maine Sea Grant in partnership with Skudik Institute and the First Coast. My name is Trevor Grandin. The 2024-2025 Kathy and Jim Giro Acadia Early Career Fellow in Science Communications at Skudik Institute. Today we'll hear from a researcher who is digitizing thousands of aerial photographs from the University of Maine's library and making them accessible online. How can these photos influence the future of land stewardship, and what can they tell us about the history of Acadia? Balloons, pigeons, and kites. These three objects have all served as vehicles for aerial photography. In 1860, floating high above the city of Boston, James Wallace Black took one of the first successful aerial photographs. He titled it Boston, as the eagle and the wild goose see it. Taken only a year before the start of the Civil War, photographs taken from balloons became a staple for military reconnaissance. By the turn of the 20th century, Lieutenant Hugh D. Wise had built an 18-foot-high kite with a box camera attached to it, and the German inventor, Dr. Julius Neubrauner, started strapping cameras to the chests of pigeons, turning them into avian paparazzo and releasing them throughout the country. After the Wright brothers' first successful flight in 1903, cameras started to make their way into airplanes, becoming tools for information in World War I and World War II. But military intel wasn't the only use for this burgeoning field. Scientists started using aerial photographs to understand difficult-to-reach geological formations like glaciers and volcanic craters. Archaeologists began to see ancient works like the ancestral Pueblo ruins of the Southwest from a different point of view, and the damage from natural disasters like earthquakes and floods became easier to assess. Sea to Trees is brought to you by Skudik Institute at Acadia National Park. I'm Trevor Grandin, and in this episode, we'll delve into the past to understand how a collection of aerial photographs once stored in a library annex are being unearthed and how they could help tell the story of modern Maine. Peter Howe's face is positioned inches away from a brightly lit table on the third floor of the University of Maine's Fogler Library. Behind a locked door in the special collections section, two negative aerial photographs of the Skudik Peninsula are side by side and backlit.
So this one here, what's the date we have on this one? This is 1955. So 125. This was one of the largest surveys we have on record, the Eastern Corporation. This survey, so let's see, there were nine rolls of, oh, here we go, yeah.
The black and white photos capture a bird's eye view of the peninsula, allowing us to study the layout of Acadia on August 25th, 1955. Like Peter said, these photos are part of film roll number 125, a series of aerial shots of Down East Maine produced for the Eastern Corporation, a paper manufacturing company that once controlled large swaths of spruce forest throughout Maine. Roll 125 is a tiny part of a much larger collection held within UMaine's Special Collections. This treasure trove of aerial photography consists of almost 3,000 canisters of film. The photographs were donated by the very organization that took them, the James W. Sewell Company. Sewell's primary directive was forestry and civil engineering. This manifested as mill operations inspections, timber appraisals, fire protection, and large-scale land surveys. A 1911 promotional pamphlet lays out their purposes to prospective clients.
Thanks to modern forestry knowledge and methods, the possible increase in the value of forest and timberlands can now be estimated with remarkable accuracy. You already know that all wooded lands are steadily increasing in value. We want you to realize that practically all these wooded lands can be appreciably enhanced in value under careful management. And that is our business, as practical foresters, to achieve the best possible results along these lines for our patrons.
As technology advanced, Sewell's operations grew wings and the survey process took an aerial approach. For almost 70 years, organizations like the Eastern Corporation, Maine Department of Transportation, and even the National Park Service hired Sewell to fly over their land and take survey photos. Equipped with a pilot and a camera operator, the small propeller planes buzzed along the landscape. A camera, like an overhead projector without an arm, poked out of a fitted hole in the plane's body and pointed at the ground. The camera operator, sitting next to the machine, shutter button in hand, snapped photos at specific moments in the air, producing a quilt of images waiting to be stitched together later. The collection includes surveys from Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, and even Vietnam during the Vietnam War. Many organizations wanted to inventory their land to understand what types of vegetation were present and in what abundance. Some flights took place during specific seasonal or weather events like leaf-offs or strong ice storms. 8 years after a fire burned over 17,000 acres of land on Mount Desert Island, a survey crew documented the newly grown forests of birch and aspen trees that took place after the blaze. All taken at different points in time, spanning from 1946 to 2015, these photographs illustrate how a landscape can change, both naturally and through human intervention. That's where Peter Howe comes in. Peter is a PhD student in the University of Maine's School of Forest Resources and an Acadia Science Fellow. He's using this collection of photographs for his own research while trying to make it accessible for the public. Working with library specialist Paul Smitherman, Peter is taking a multi-step approach to his research.
You know, my little piece of this project is many parts. Like, definitely the big collaborative first step that I'm working with Paul on is we just need to get a lot of this digitized, because just a small fraction of the archive has been digitized at this point. And then getting them stitched together into these geo-referenced mosaics that we can compare to the modern landscape and modern imagery. And then from there, looking closer at the forest and trying to understand forest change across time, which is where I'm hoping to do more GIS analysis.
And that first step, the digitization, may be Peter's largest step. Because behind the locked doors of the special collection storage lies a small fraction of his work.
So this is what, 1% of everything?
This 1% of the film collection takes the form of two floor-to-ceiling long metal shelves filled top to bottom with jet black canisters. Each canister is about the height of a roll of paper towels and weighs over 15 pounds. A bright yellow Kodak sticker swiped across the front of the canisters labels them as infrared aerographic safety film. The tops of the canisters are labeled with their respective numbers, the organizations that commissioned them, the date they were taken, and their scale. The other 99% of the film is stored in a University of Maine annex across campus, sitting snugly on rolling library stacks.
Somewhere up there is the number 5 canister,
probably on that top shelf.
That's 1949.
Yeah. Would be some of the earliest.
Prior to Peter's research, Smitherman was manually scanning in film as it was requested. If someone asked for a photo, for example, of Hancock County, he could scan a couple of them and send them on their way. Using this manual scanning process, it takes about 10 minutes to upload one roll. With over 3,000 canisters in the collection, it would take over 20 days of continuous, around-the-clock scanning to digitize every roll. But thanks to funding from the Northeastern State Research Cooperative and Acadia Science Fellowship, the project now has access to an automatic scanner. In its idle form, the UltraScan 5000 looks like a powder blue pancake griddle. Taking up the entire tabletop, the heavy rectangular machine's lid has two black plastic coverings on either side. Lifting the lid illuminates what's hiding under those exterior coverings. Two black batons, like plastic rolling pins, hold the film rolls and gently rotate, spooling and unspooling the negatives over the glass scanning table in the middle. Load the roll up, let the spokes rotate, and they can scan the photos automatically. Although the scanner is an obvious upgrade, it comes with its own set of quirks. Made in 1999, the model was discontinued in the early 2000s. Consequently, there is no technical support that goes along with the scanner, and no updates for its software. Without updates, the scanner can only run on Windows XP, an operating system that works on a choice number of older computers.
So we had to find a dated computer that wasn't too fast, but wasn't too slow, and then using the software that hasn't been updated, you know, they stopped making it. Back in 2000. So,
scanning a whole roll of film manually wouldn't be such a big hassle if they only had a couple photos inside, but each roll of film comes with around 250 negatives. The rolls also contain an important component for interpreting the photos, a flight index.
So with each photo survey, they would produce these maps. It's a photo index that shows where each photograph was taken. And so these are the flight lines that the pilots flew. And so they would fly in this very regular patterned route. And part of that is because they really wanted to ensure that they captured, you know, every square inch of the land that they were sort of surveying, but also that there was overlap between photographs. Because even then, back then, they were doing kind of an earlier form of photogrammetry that is what I'm doing today.
Photogrammetry, a word from Greek, can be broken down into three parts. Phos, meaning light, gram, meaning drawing, and metrine, the noun for measure. Put simply, the process of measuring an object using a photograph. A more complicated explanation comes from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Photogrammetry is a method of approximating a three-dimensional structure using two-dimensional images. Photographs are stitched together using special software to make the 3D models and photomosaic maps. This method of measurement can be used to map topography, model shipwrecks, statues, and even large-scale forests.
So there's kind of two outputs that the photogrammetry process can produce, one being an orthomosaic, that's this stitched together composite image, and then the other being this actual three-dimensional model of what's in the photographs. So it's really amazing that we can get a three-dimensional model of the historical landscape that even captures, you know, tree height, forest canopy height back in time. So we're really excited about it.
After the scanning process, these aerial negatives are uploaded into Peter's photogrammetry software and put together along overlapping edges. The map that's created is a tapestry of negative photographs for a specific region during a specific year. You're listening to WERU Community Radio at 89.9 FM and streaming online at weru.org. Processes like Peter's, digitizing and uploading historical negatives, have been happening for a while.
We've had printed air photos here for years, probably since about the 1980s.
That's Christian Halstead, Director of Earth Resources Information at the Maine Geological Survey, and he's in charge of the Geological Survey's aerial photograph collection.
You know, they sit in filing cabinets, and you kind of have to know to contact us, you know, to come in and look at them. So we recognized that they weren't getting a lot of use because they were sort of a hidden treasure, hidden resource.
After receiving USGS funding to digitize their collection, Maine Geological Survey created their own interactive map. There are many similarities between the MGS map and Peter Howe's Atlas. Both collections are made of photographs produced by the Sewell Company. Both are for public reference at any time, and both can be filtered by year, but they're distinct in important ways.
We didn't geo-reference each individual photo into a mosaic like you would think of, like Google Maps, like a seamless photo layer. But what we did is we geolocated each photo. And so that's when you zoom in an area and you click on it, you basically just get the photos that overlap that area that you clicked on, and then you can kind of review them individually and see if one or multiple photos are the ones you're looking for.
But Peter's project goes one step further than scanning and uploading. To tie these historical photographs to the present, Peter clicks through every negative and places what's called a ground control point. These points are primarily located on objects and features he knows haven't moved since the photograph was taken.
A good point would be a great rock,
okay,
or a farmhouse, or a bridge, or a road intersection, something that really clearly comes to a point that's exposed, that we know, you know, won't be later covered by canopy, and things that we're really sure haven't moved.
Once these control points are established in the historical photographs, the computer finds those unmoved points in modern satellite imagery, allowing for an almost seamless overlay of historical and current imagery. The product? The Northeastern Forest Historical Atlas, a site similar to Google Earth, but where many are used to seeing the emerald expanse of Maine, black and white TV static has taken its place. Zoom in a little further, and the static morphs into pockets of historical photographs intermixed with current satellite imagery. Film is still the ideal way to capture aerial photography in many ways. Film resolution is so clear that you can drop into individual streets with almost no loss of clarity. Still, film cameras capture more detailed photos than the digital cameras many use today. Looking at Bar Harbor while flipping between historical and present photography uncovers the buildings, the parking lots, and the roads that were or weren't present in 1966. Across Mount Desert Island, the ponds and lakes grow and shrink from past to present, suspended at the exact height they were in 1955. This unique perspective can foster a change in spatial understanding. Individual environments and landscapes that are often only seen from eye level are looked on from up above. Roads that often seem so permanent and reliable are shrunken into small veins that snake throughout wider wilderness. From ground level, our world is relegated to what is directly around us. But the aerial photographs reaffirm our understanding of nature's connectedness. And as more film rolls are scanned in and geolocated, the historical layers to choose from will only grow, expanding their uses.
You know, I'm working with a few foresters who are interested in understanding the logging history, the forest disturbance history, you know, in the land that they manage, understanding successional change, understanding fire histories, understanding insect and disease histories, spruce budworm being a huge one for a lot of inland Maine.
The aerial photography that Peter is digitizing will be of use to those right here in Acadia National Park. Restoration work on the summit of Acadia's mountains is seeking to revegetate areas worn down by visitors and natural erosion. Thousands of pounds of soil have already been trekked up to the top of Sargent and Penobscot Mountains with the hope that plants will take hold once again.
As we move forward and get and you'll get more iterations of aerial photography and remote sensing data from now on, that's going to help us in kind of having a big picture monitoring of and tracking of progress as we restore square footage or square meters, right? Or like how much area, right, are we restoring to vegetation?
That's Jesse Wheeler, vegetation biologist at Acadia National Park. He leads many of the park's invasive species management programs, and his team plays a big part in revegetating the summits of Acadia. Throughout its history, different approaches have been taken to manage Acadia's plants. Especially on mountain summits, studies that involve remote sensing and aerial photography have already proven beneficial to park managers like Jesse. In 2022, John Daigle of the University of Maine and Min-Koo Kim of Marshall University used satellite imagery to analyze mountain summits throughout the park. They determined what areas had seen growth during restoration efforts and what areas were still under stress, creating a better picture for Acadia's present. Paired with Peter's historical photography, these studies could greatly impact restoration efforts all around Acadia.
And so being able to have some coarse scale and fine scale monitoring of what's going on up there as we're putting forth all this effort and resources, is we could track that over time. And I think a great way to do that is using aerial photography.
The possibilities are endless for Peter's work, with organizations and individuals all over the place wanting a piece of what he's creating. MGS's Christian Halstead explains how varied the uses have been for the Geological Survey's collection.
Quite frankly, we use the photos ourself, within the main geological survey, questions around changing sea level and shoreline changes and movement of bluffs and dunes and coastal erosion.
Whether it's for ecological research or personal interest, access to these historical photographs helps us better understand our place in history. To some, the outcomes of the past seemed so set in stone without visual evidence, so certain. What a landscape looked like before a life-altering fire, mountain summits prior to intensive use, or townships before urbanization. There was a time before these events and man-made structures, and they're not as permanent as many think. Peter Howe, once again.
I like the term historical ecology because it's all about bringing together, what we might call natural and human histories, and really understanding those as totally intertwined and not, not separate histories, but these very interconnected histories that have shaped each other across time. And that's very clear when you look at this, imagery.
Thank you for listening to Sea to Trees, a podcast from Skudik Institute at Acadia National Park. Acadia National Park is on the traditional lands of the Wabanaki, people of the dawn. This show was made by me, Trevor Grandin, the Kathy and Jim Giro Acadia Early Career Fellow in Science Communication. Catherine Schmidt is our senior editor. The cover art was created by Sarah Lucchini. Special thanks to Peter Howe, Paul Smitherman, Jesse Wheeler, and Christian Halstead for sharing their expertise with us. This podcast is possible with generous support through the Kathy and Jim Giro Acadia Early Career Fellowship, a partnership among Skudik Institute, National Park Foundation, and National Park Service. As a nonprofit partner of the National Park Service, Skudik Institute inspires science, learning, and community for a changing world. To learn more, visit skudikinstitute.org. Join us next month to hear about two survey projects that are taking the pulse of amphibian and small mammal populations in Acadia National Park. Here's a sneak peek. Acadia is covered in more than 30 miles of roads that connect culturally significant and visually stunning landmarks all across the island. The roads provide access to a number of wetlands, a habitat that makes up more than 20% of Acadia's parkland. Some of these wetlands, like Great Meadow, are fed by freshwater streams, while some, like Bass Harbor Marsh, are salt marshes that ebb and flow with the tidal clock. The 15 sites that Marisa and her volunteers survey range in popularity from busy portions of Park Loop Road to silent stretches of Skudik Peninsula. For every survey location, a volunteer carries with them a bright green data sheet printed on waterproof paper. They mark the age of the amphibian, adult or juvenile, whether it's alive or dead, and its species. There are 13 different species of amphibians that have been documented in Acadia National Park and 18 in the state of Maine. The American toad makes up Acadia's one lone toad species. There are 6 frog species that include the American bullfrog, green frog, gray tree frog, spring peeper, and...
Ooh. Hello, beautiful! This is a pickerel frog. A very common frog. Really beautiful. So this frog sometimes gets confused for a leopard frog. And if anyone sees a leopard frog in Acadia, they should take a picture. Because we don't have any actual photographic evidence that they're here.
There are 6 salamander species. The spotted salamander, redback salamander, northern dusky salamander, northern two-lined salamander, and...
Oh! It's a new species. This is a four-toed salamander. I believe, yes. Okay, so you see... You see how he's got this little, pug nose. Mm-hmm. And then it looks like there's sort of like a little constriction at the base of his tail. Right there. Mm-hmm. And then you can even see his tail looks like a different color than his body.
Yeah. Body. He's got little flecks in his
tail. And then his heart belly is beautiful. It's like a spotted pepper. Salt and pepper here. Beautiful belly.
Yeah.
They've got four toes on the back feet. One of the tiniest feet you might ever see.
The last salamander, the eastern newt, is commonly found waddling across wet roadways on spring nights, but not in the form one would expect. Newts have that one extra step in the middle of their larval and adult stages mentioned earlier, called a red eft, E-F-T. Bright orange and slow moving, these critters are hard to miss. Although it's perfectly safe to handle red efts, their bright coloring broadcasts an important message in the animal kingdom. I am highly poisonous. You do not want to eat me. This tactic, called aposematism, is important for such a small and edible creature. Back in the woods, Brittany, her crew, and I came upon another trap, with its front hatch already closed. Excitedly, we gathered around the small metal box. Gloves on and plastic bag at the ready, Brittany peered into the trap expectantly. Tipping the contents into the bag, she says,
"So, this is a woodland jumping mouse."
As the jumping mouse slid around the plastic bag, Brittany hooked the tube scale to the top and tried to measure the mouse's weight.
I know. Should weigh this guy in the trap. 32 grams. So, one of their escape mechanisms is they jump. These guys can actually jump up to, I believe it's 3 meters. Be a smushed body length, Dylan. So it's moving quite a bit on me. So yeah, 50 for body, but put in the notes, please, that that's smushed. Okay, let's see if we can get this guy out.
Opening up the bag and dipping her gloved hand inside, Brittany pinched his back and carefully raised him into the fresh air. She clutched her ruler and started to inspect the mouse.
Nope. I can turn on you with this.
As Brittany spoke, the mouse twisted its body in her hand and, like a swimmer at the starting block, placed its two hind feet against her palm.
Big ol'. Okay, bag please. Bag please. Bag please. Bag please. Bag please. Bag please. And then. So these guys can turn really easily when they get that hind foot on you. And that's why you gotta keep a hold of their tail.
After a few more measurements, the team decided to put an ear tag on him and let him go. Leaping from Brittany's hand, the mouse dove into the brush and disappeared with a series of hops. Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of Coastal Conversations. Join us on the fourth Friday of each month at 4 p.m. for information, stories, and conversations about the issues and people of the Maine Coast. On behalf of Maine Sea Grant and in partnership with Skootic Institute and the First Coast, safe travels.